but previously neglected men, such as Grigory Peshkov, had been promoted to take the places of those purged, and Grigory's career had a new impetus. He was in charge of the defense of Moscow against air raids, and was frantically busy. His enhanced status was probably the reason why Volodya was not among those scapegoated for the failure of Stalin's Spanish policy. The unpleasant Ilya Dvorkin had also somehow avoided punishment. He was back in Moscow and married to Volodya's sister, Anya, much to Volodya's regret. There was no accounting for women's choices in such matters. She was already pregnant, and Volodya could not repress a nightmare image of her nursing a baby with the head of a rat. After a brief leave, Volodya had been posted to Berlin, where he had to prove his worth all over again. He looked up from his paper to see Werner walking along the street. Werner had not changed much. He was a little taller and broader, but he had the same strawberry blonde hair falling over his forehead in a way girls had found irresistible, the same look of tolerant amusement in his blue eyes. He wore an elegant light blue summer suit, and gold links glinted at his cuffs. There was no one following him. Volodya crossed the road and intercepted him before he reached the café. Werner smiled broadly, showing white teeth.
"I wouldn't have recognized you with that army haircut," he said. "It's good to see you after all these years."
He had not lost any of his warmth and charm, Volodya noted.
"Let's go inside." "You don't really want to go into that dump, do you?" Werner said. "It will be full of plumbers eating sausages with mustard." "I want to get off the street. Here we could be seen by anyone passing. There's an alley 3 doors down." "Good."
They walked a short distance and turned into a narrow passage between a coal yard and a grocery store.
"What have you been doing?" Werner said.
"Fighting the fascists, just like you."
Volodya considered whether to tell him more.
"I was in Spain."
It was no secret.
"There you had no more success than we did here in Germany.
But it's not over yet."
"Let me ask you something,"
Werner said, leaning against the wall.
"If you thought Bolshevism was wicked, would you be a spy working against the Soviet Union?"
Volodya's instinct was to say, "No, absolutely not." But before the words came out, he realized how tactless that would be, for the prospect that revolted him was precisely what Werner was doing, betraying his country for the sake of a higher cause.
"I don't know," he said. "I think it must be very difficult for you to work against Germany, even though you hate the Nazis."
"You're right," Werner said.
"And what happens if war breaks out? Am I going to help you kill our soldiers and bomb our cities?"
Volodya was worried. It seemed that Werner was weakening.
"It's the only way to defeat the Nazis," he said. "You know that."
"I do. I made my decision a long time ago, and the Nazis have done nothing to change my mind. It's hard, that's all."
"I understand,"
Volodya said sympathetically.
Werner said, "You asked me to suggest other people who might do for you what I do."
Volodya nodded.
"People like Willy Frunzer. Remember him? Cleverest boy in school? He was a serious socialist. He chaired that meeting the brown shirts broke up."
Werner shook his head.
"He went to England."
Volodya's heart sank.
"Why?"
"He's a brilliant physicist and he's studying in London."
"Shit."
"But I've thought of someone else."
"Good.
Did you ever know Heinrich von Kessel?"
"I don't think so.
Was he at our school?"
"No.
He went to a Catholic school, and in those days he didn't share our politics either. His father was a big shot in the Center Party, which put Hitler in power in 1933.
"Correct.
Heinrich was then working for his father. The father has now joined the Nazis, but the son is wrecked by guilt."
"How do you know?"
"He got drunk and told my sister, Frieda. She's 17. I think he fancies her."
This was promising. Volodya's spirits lifted.
"Is he a communist?"
"No."
"What makes you think he'll work for us?"
"I asked him straight out. If you got a chance to fight against the Nazis by spying for the Soviet Union, would you do it?"
He said he would.
"What's his job?"
"He's in the army, but he has a weak chest. So they made him a pen pusher, which is lucky for us, because now he works for the Supreme High Command in the Economic Planning and Procurement Department.
The lodger was impressed. Such a man would know exactly how many trucks and tanks and machine guns and submarines the German military was acquiring month by month, and where they were being deployed. He began to feel excited.
When can I meet him?
Now. I've arranged to have a drink with him in the Hotel Adlon after work. Volodya groaned. The Adlon was Berlin's swankiest hotel. It was located on Unter den Linden. Because it was in the government and diplomatic district, the bar was a favorite haunt of journalists, hoping to pick up gossip. It would not have been Volodya's choice of rendezvous, but he could not afford to miss this chance.
All right, he said, but I'm not going to be seen talking to either of you in that place. I'll follow you in, identify Heinrich, then follow him out and accost him later.
Okay, I'll drive you there. My car's around the corner. As they walked to the other end of the alley, Werner told Volodya Heinrich's work and home addresses and phone numbers, and Volodya committed them to memory.
Here we are, said Werner. Jump in.
The car was a Mercedes 540K Autobahn Courier, a model that was head-turningly beautiful, with sensually curved fenders, a bonnet larger than an entire Ford Model T, and a sloping fastback rear end. It was so expensive that only a handful had ever been sold. Volodya stared aghast.
Shouldn't you have a less ostentatious car? He said incredulously.
It's a double bluff, Werner said. They think no real spy would be so flamboyant. Volodya was going to ask how he could afford it. But then he recalled that Werner's father was a wealthy manufacturer.
I'm not getting into that thing, Volodya said. I'll go by train.
As you wish.
I'll see you at the Adlon, but don't acknowledge me.
Of course. Half an hour later, Volodya saw Werner's car carelessly parked in front of the hotel. This cavalier attitude of Werner seemed foolish to him, but now he wondered whether it was a necessary element of Werner's courage. Perhaps Werner had to pretend to be carefree in order to take the appalling risks required to spy on the Nazis. If he acknowledged the danger he was in, maybe he would not be able to carry on. The bar of the Adlon was full of fashionable women and well-dressed men, many in smartly tailored uniforms. Volodya spotted Werner right away, at a table with another man who was, presumably, Heinrich von Kessel. Passing close to them, Volodya heard Heinrich say argumentatively,
Buck Clayton is a much better trumpeter than Hot Lips Page.
He squeezed in at the counter, ordered a beer, and discreetly studied the new potential spy. Heinrich had pale skin and thick dark hair that was long by army standards. Although they were talking about the relatively unimportant topic of jazz, he seemed very intense, arguing with gestures and repeatedly running his fingers through his hair. He had a book stuffed into the pocket of his uniform tunic, and Volodya would have bet it contained poetry. Volodya drank two beers slowly and pretended to read the Morgenpost from cover to cover. He tried not to get too keyed up about Heinrich. The man was thrillingly promising, but there was no guarantee he would cooperate. Recruiting informers was the hardest part of Volodya's work. Precautions were difficult to take, because the target was not yet on his side. The proposition often had to be made in inappropriate places, usually somewhere public. It was impossible to know how the target would react. He might be angry and shout his refusal, or be terrified and literally run away. But there was not much the recruiter could do to control the situation. At some point, he just had to ask the simple, blunt question, "Do you want to be a spy?" He thought about how to approach Heinrich. Religion was probably the key to his personality. Volodya recalled his boss, Lemitov, saying,
Lapsed Catholics make good agents. They reject the total authority of the church, only to accept the total authority of the party.
Heinrich might need to seek forgiveness for what he had done, but would he risk his life? At last Werner paid the bill and the two men left. Volodya followed. Outside the hotel they parted company, Werner driving off with a squeal of tires, and Heinrich going on foot across the park. Volodya went after Heinrich. Night was falling, but the sky was clear and he could see well. There were many people strolling in the warm evening air, most of them in couples. Volodya looked back repeatedly to make sure no one had followed him or Heinrich from the Adlon. When he was satisfied, he took a deep breath, steeled his nerve, and caught up with Heinrich. Walking alongside him, Volodya said, "There is atonement for sin." Heinrich looked at him warily, as at someone who might be mad. "Are you a priest?
You could strike back at the wicked regime you helped to create."
Heinrich kept walking but looked worried.
"Who are you? What do you know about me?"
Volodya continued to ignore Heinrich's questions.
"The Nazis will be defeated one day. That day could come sooner with your help.
If you're a Gestapo agent hoping to entrap me, don't bother. I'm a loyal German."
"Do you notice my accent?"
"Yes. You sound Russian."
"How many Gestapo agents speak German with a Russian accent? Or have the imagination to fake it?"
Heinrich laughed nervously. "I know nothing about Gestapo agents," he said. "I shouldn't have mentioned the subject. Very foolish of me."
"Your office produces reports of the quantities of armaments and other supplies ordered by the military. Copies of those reports could be immeasurably useful to the enemies of the Nazis."
"To the Red Army, you mean?
Who else is going to destroy this regime?"
"We keep careful track of all copies of such reports."
Volodya suppressed a surge of triumph. Heinrich was thinking about practical difficulties. That meant he was inclined to agree in principle.
"Make an extra carbon," Volodya said, "or write out a copy in longhand. Or take someone's file copy. There are ways."
"Of course there are. And any of them could get me killed.
If we do nothing about the crimes that are being committed by this regime, is life worth living?"
Heinrich stopped and stared at Volodya. Volodya could not guess what the man was thinking, but instinct told him to remain quiet. After a long pause, Heinrich sighed and said,
"I'll think about it."
"I have him,"
Volodya thought exultantly.
Heinrich said, "How do I contact you?"
"You don't,"
Volodya said. "I will contact you."
He touched the brim of his hat, then walked back the way he had come. He felt exultant. If Heinrich had not meant to accept the proposition, he would have rejected it firmly. His promising to think about it was almost as good as acceptance. He would sleep on it. He would run over the dangers. But he would do it, eventually, Volodya felt almost certain. He told himself not to be overconfident. 100 things could go wrong. All the same, he was full of hope as he left the park and walked in bright lights past the shops and restaurants of Unter den Linden. He had had no dinner, but he could not afford to eat on this street. He took a tram eastward into the low-rent neighborhood called Friedrichshain and made his way to a small apartment in a tenement. The door was opened by a short, pretty girl of 18 with fair hair. She wore a pink sweater and dark slacks, and her feet were bare. Although she was slim, she had delightfully generous breasts.
"I'm sorry to call unexpectedly," Volodya said. "Is it inconvenient?"
She smiled.
"Not at all," she said. "Come in."
He stepped inside. She closed the door, then threw her arms around him.
"I'm always happy to see you," she said, and kissed him eagerly.
Lily Marekrath was a girl with a lot of affection to give. Volodya had been taking her out about once a week since he got back to Berlin. He was not in love with her, and he knew that she dated other men, including Werner. But when they were together, she was passionate. After a moment, she said,
"Have you heard the news? Is that why you've come?"
"What news?"
Lily worked as a secretary in a press agency, and always heard things first.
"The Soviet Union has made a pact with Germany," she said.
That made no sense.
"You mean with Britain and France, against Germany?"
"No, I don't. That's the surprise. Stalin and Hitler have made friends."
"But..."
Volodya trailed off, baffled. Friends with Hitler? It seemed crazy. Was this the solution devised by the new Soviet foreign minister, Molotov? "We have failed to stop the tide of world fascism, so we give up trying? Did my father fight a revolution for that?"
3.
Woody Doer saw Joanne Ruzrock again after 4 years. No one who knew her father actually believed he had tried to rape a starlet in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel. The girl had dropped the charges, but that was dull news, and the papers had given it little prominence. Consequently, Dave was still a rapist in the eyes of Buffalo people. So Joanne's parents had moved to Palm Beach, and Woody lost touch. Next time he saw her, it was in the White House. Woody was with his father, Senator Gus Doer, and they were going to see the president. Woody had met Franklin D. Roosevelt several times. His father and the president had been friends for many years. But those had been social occasions, when FDR had shaken Woody's hand and asked him how he was getting along at school. This would be the first time Woody attended a real political meeting with the president. They went in through the main entrance of the West Wing, passed through the entrance lobby, and stepped into a large waiting room. And there she was. Woody stared at her in delight. She had hardly changed. With her narrow, haughty face and curved nose, she still looked like the high priestess of an ancient religion. As ever, she wore simple clothes to dramatic effect. Today she had on a dark blue suit of some cool fabric, and a straw hat the same color with a big brim. Woody was glad he had put on a clean white shirt and his new striped tie this morning. She seemed pleased to see him.
"You look great," she said. "Are you working in D.C. now?"
"Just helping out in my father's office for the summer," he replied. "I'm still at Harvard." She turned to his father and said deferentially, "Good afternoon, Senator." "Hello, Joanne." Woody was thrilled to run into her. She was as alluring as ever. He wanted to keep the conversation going.
"What are you doing here?" Woody said. "I work at the State Department."
Woody nodded. That explained her deference to his father. She had joined a world in which people kowtowed to Senator Doer. Woody said, "What's your job?" "I'm assistant to an assistant. My boss is with the president now, but I'm too lowly to go in with him."
"You were always interested in politics. I recall an argument about lynching."
"I miss Buffalo. What fun we used to have."
Woody remembered kissing her at the racquet club ball, and he felt himself blush. His father said, "Please give my best regards to your father," indicating that they needed to move on. Woody considered asking for her phone number, but she preempted him.
"I'd love to see you again, Woody," she said.
He was delighted.
"Sure. Are you free tonight?
I'm having a few friends for cocktails."
"Sounds great."
She gave him the address, an apartment building not far away. Then his father hurried him out of the other end of the room. A guard nodded familiarly to Gus, and they stepped into another waiting room. Gus said, "Now, Woody, don't say anything unless the president addresses you directly." Woody tried to concentrate on the imminent meeting. There had been a political earthquake in Europe. The Soviet Union had signed a peace pact with Nazi Germany, upsetting everyone's calculations. Woody's father was a key member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and the president wanted to know what he thought. Gus Doer had another subject to discuss. He wanted to persuade Roosevelt to revive the League of Nations. It would be a tough sell. The USA had never joined the League, and Americans did not much like it. The League had failed dismally to deal with the crises of the 1930s, Japanese aggression in the Far East, Italian imperialism in Africa, Nazi takeovers in Europe, the ruin of democracy in Spain. But Gus was determined to try. It had always been his dream, Woody knew, a world council to resolve conflicts and prevent war. Woody was 100% behind him. He had made a speech about this in a Harvard debate. When two nations had a quarrel, the worst possible procedure was for men to kill people on the other side. That seemed to him pretty obvious. "I understand why it happens, of course," he had said in the debate, "just like I understand why drunks get into fistfights, but that doesn't make it any less irrational." But now Woody found it hard to think about the threat of war in Europe. All his old feelings about Joanne came back in a rush. He wondered if she would kiss him again, maybe tonight. She had always liked him, and it seemed she still did. Why else would she have invited him to her party? She had refused to date him back in 1935 because he had been 15 and she 18, which was understandable, though he had not thought so at the time. But now that they were both 4 years older, the age difference would not seem so stark, would it? He hoped not. He had dated girls in Buffalo and at Harvard, but he had not felt for any of them the overwhelming passion he had had for Joanne. "Have you got that?" his father said. Woody felt foolish.
His father was about to make a proposal to the president that could bring world peace, and all Woody could think about was kissing Joanne.
Sure,
he said. I won't say anything unless he speaks to me first. A tall, slim woman in her early 40s came into the room, looking relaxed and confident, as if she owned the place. And Woody recognized Marguerite Lehand, nicknamed Missy, who managed Roosevelt's office. She had a long, masculine face with a big nose, and there was a touch of gray in her dark hair. She smiled warmly at Gus. What a pleasure to see you again, Senator.
How are you, Missy?
You remember my son, Woodrow.
I do. The president is ready for you both.
Missy's devotion to Roosevelt was famous. FDR was more fond of her than a married man was entitled to be, according to Washington gossip. Woody knew, from guarded but revealing remarks his parents made to one another, that Roosevelt's wife, Eleanor, had refused to sleep with him since she gave birth to their sixth child. The paralysis, which had struck him 5 years later, did not extend to his sexual equipment. Perhaps a man who had not slept with his wife for 20 years was entitled to an affectionate secretary. She showed them through another door and across a narrow corridor. Then they were in the Oval Office. The president sat at a desk with his back to three tall windows in a curving bay. The blinds were drawn to filter the August sun coming through the south-facing glass. Roosevelt used an ordinary office chair, Woody saw, not his wheelchair. He wore a white suit and he was smoking a cigarette in a holder. He was not really handsome. He had receding hair and a jutting chin, and he wore pince-nez glasses that made his eyes seem too close together. All the same, there was something immediately attractive about his engaging smile, his hand extended to shake, and the amiable tone of voice in which he said, "Good to see you, Gus. Come on in." "Mr. President, you remember my elder son, Woodrow?" "Of course. How's Harvard, Woody?"
"Just fine, sir. Thank you. I'm on the debating team."
He knew that politicians often had the knack of seeming to know everyone intimately. Either they had remarkable memories, or their secretaries reminded them efficiently.
"I was at Harvard myself."
"Sit down, sit down." Roosevelt removed the end of his cigarette from the holder and stubbed it in a full ashtray.
"Gus, what the heck is happening in Europe?"
The president knew what was happening in Europe, of course, thought Woody. He had an entire State Department to tell him, but he wanted Gus Dewar's analysis. Gus said, "Germany and Russia are still mortal enemies, in my opinion." "That's what we all thought. But then why have they signed this pact?" "Short-term convenience for both. Stalin needs time. He wants to build up the Red Army so they can defeat the Germans if it comes to that. And the other guy? Hitler is clearly on the point of doing something to Poland. The German press is full of ridiculous stories about how the Poles are mistreating their German-speaking population. Hitler doesn't stir up hatred without a purpose. Whatever he's planning, he doesn't want the Soviets to stand in his way. Hence the pact." "That's pretty much what Hull says." Cordell Hull was Secretary of State, but he doesn't know what will happen next. Will Stalin let Hitler do anything he wants? My guess is they'll carve up Poland between them in the next couple of weeks. And then what? A few hours ago, the British signed a new treaty with the Poles, promising to come to their aid if they're attacked. But what can they do?
Nothing, sir.
The British Army, Navy, and Air Force have no power to prevent the Germans overrunning Poland.
What do you think we should do, Gus?
Said the president. Woody knew that this was his father's chance. He had the president's attention for a few minutes. It was a rare opportunity to make something happen. Woody discreetly crossed his fingers. Gus leaned forward.
We don't want our sons to go to war as we did.
Roosevelt had four boys in their 20s and 30s. Woody suddenly understood why he was here. He had been brought to the meeting to remind the president of his own sons. Gus said quietly, "We can't send American boys to be slaughtered in Europe again. The world needs a police force."
"What do you have in mind?"
Roosevelt said non-committally. "The League of Nations isn't such a failure as people think. In the 1920s, it resolved a border dispute between Finland and Sweden, and another between Turkey and Iraq." Gus was ticking items off on his fingers. It stopped Greece and Yugoslavia from invading Albania and persuaded Greece to pull out of Bulgaria. And it sent a peacekeeping force to keep Colombia and Peru from hostilities. All true, but in the 30s, the League was not strong enough to deal with fascist aggression. It's not surprising. The League was crippled from the start because Congress refused to ratify the Covenant, so the United States was never a member. We need a new American-led version with teeth. Gus paused. Mr. President, it's too soon to give up on a peaceful world. Woody held his breath. Roosevelt nodded, but then he always nodded, Woody knew. It was rare for him to disagree openly. He hated confrontation. You had to be careful, Woody had heard his father say, not to take his silence for consent. Woody did not dare look at his father, sitting beside him, but he could sense the tension. At last, the president said, I believe you're right. Woody had to restrain himself from whooping aloud. The president had consented. He looked at his father. The normally imperturbable Gus was barely concealing his surprise. It had been such a quick victory. Gus moved rapidly to consolidate it. In that case, may I suggest that Cordell Hull and I draft a proposal for your consideration? Hull has a lot on his plate. Talk to Wells. Sumner Wells was Undersecretary of State. He was both ambitious and flamboyant, and Woody knew he would not have been Gus's first choice. But he was a longtime friend of the Roosevelt family. He had been a page boy at FDR's wedding. Anyway, Gus was not going to make difficulties at this point. By all means, he said. Anything else? That was clearly a dismissal. Gus stood up, and Woody followed suit. Gus said, What about Mrs. Roosevelt, your mother, sir? Last I heard, she was in France. Her ship left yesterday, thank goodness. I'm glad to hear it. Thank you for coming in, Roosevelt said. I really value your friendship, Gus. Gus said, Nothing could give me more pleasure, sir. He shook hands with the president, and Woody did the same. Then they left. Woody half hoped that Joanne would still be hanging around, but she had gone. As they made their way out of the building, Gus said, Let's go for a celebratory drink. Woody looked at his watch. It was 5 o'clock. Sure, he said. They went to Old Ebbitt on 15th Street near F. Stained glass, green velvet, brass lamps and hunting trophies. The place was full of congressmen, senators, and the people who followed them around, aides, lobbyists, and journalists. Gus ordered a dry martini straight up with a twist for himself and a beer for Woody. Woody smiled. Maybe he would have liked a martini. In fact, he would not. To him it just tasted like cold gin, but it would have been nice to be asked. However, he raised his glass and said, Congratulations. You got what you wanted. What the world needs. You argued brilliantly. Roosevelt hardly needed convincing. He's a liberal, but a pragmatist. He knows you can't do everything. You have to pick the battles you can win. The New Deal is his number one priority, getting unemployed men back to work. He won't do anything that interferes with the main mission. If my plan becomes controversial enough to upset his supporters, he'll drop it. So we haven't won anything yet. Gus smiled. We've taken the important first step. But no, we haven't won anything. A pity he forced Wells on you. Not entirely. Sumner strengthens the project. He's closer to the president than I am. But he's unpredictable. He might pick it up and run in a different direction. Woody looked across the room and saw a familiar face. Guess who's here? I might have known. His father looked in the same direction. Standing at the bar, Woody said, with a couple of older guys in hats, and a blonde girl. It's Greg Peshkov. As usual, Greg looked a mess, despite his expensive clothes. His silk tie was awry, his shirt was coming out of his waistband, and there was a smear of cigarette ash on his ice cream-colored trousers. Nevertheless, the blonde was looking adoringly at him. So it is, said Gus. Do you see much of him at Harvard? He's a physics major, but he doesn't hang around with the scientists. Too dull for him, I guess. I ran into him at the Crimson. The Harvard Crimson was the student newspaper. Woody took photographs for the paper and Greg wrote articles. He's doing an internship at the State Department this summer. That's why he's here. In the press office, I imagine, said Gus. The two men he's with are reporters.
the one in the brown suit for the Chicago Tribune, and the pipe smoker for the Cleveland Plain Dealer. Woody saw that Greg was talking to the journalists as if they were old friends, taking the arm of one as he leaned forward to say something in a low voice, patting the other on the back in mock congratulation. They seemed to like him, Woody thought, as they laughed loudly at something he said. Woody envied that talent. It was useful to politicians, though perhaps not essential. His father did not have that hail fellow well-met quality, and he was one of the most senior statesmen in America. Woody said, I wonder how his half-sister, Daisy, feels about the threat of war. She's over there in London. She married some English lord. To be exact, she married the elder son of Earl Fitzherbert, whom I used to know quite well. She's the envy of every girl in Buffalo. The king went to her wedding. I also knew Fitzherbert's sister, Maud. Wonderful woman. She married Walter von Ulrich, a German. I would have married him myself if Walter hadn't got to her first. Woody raised his eyebrows. It was not like Papa to talk this way. That was before I fell in love with your mother, of course. Of course. Woody smothered a grin. Walter and Maud dropped out of sight after Hitler banned the Social Democrats. I hope they're all right. If there's a war. Woody saw the talk of war had put his father in a reminiscent mood. At least America isn't involved. That's what we thought last time. Gus changed the subject. What do you hear from your kid brother? Woody sighed. He's not going to change his mind, Papa. He won't go to Harvard or any other university. This was a family crisis. Chuck had announced that as soon as he was 18, he was going to join the Navy. Without a college degree, he would be an enlisted man, with no prospect of ever becoming an officer. This horrified his high-achieving parents. He's bright enough for college, damn it, said Gus. He beats me at chess. He beats me, too. So what's his problem? He hates to study, and he loves boats. Sailing is the only thing he cares about. Woody looked at his wristwatch. You've got a party to go to, his father said. There's no hurry. Sure there is. She's a very attractive girl. Get the hell out of here. Woody grinned. His father could be surprisingly smart. Thanks, Papa. He got up. Greg Peshkov was leaving at the same time, and they went out together. Hello, Woody. How are things? Greg said amiably, turning in the same direction. There had been a time when Woody wanted to punch Greg for his part in what had been done to Dave Ruzrock. His feelings had cooled over the years, and in truth it was Lev Peshkov who had been responsible, not his son, who had then been only 15. All the same, Woody was no more than polite. I'm enjoying Washington, he said, walking along one of the city's wide Parisian boulevards. How about you? I like it. They soon get over their surprise at my name. Seeing Woody's inquiring look, Greg explained, the State Department is all Smiths, Fabers, Jensens, and McAllisters. No one called Kaczynski or Cohen or Papadopoulos. Woody realized it was true. Government was carried on by a rather exclusive little ethnic group. Why had he not noticed that before? Perhaps because it had been the same in school, in church, and at Harvard. Greg went on, but they're not narrow-minded. They'll make an exception for someone who speaks fluent Russian and comes from a wealthy family. Greg was being flippant, but there was an undertone of real resentment, and Woody saw that the guy had a serious chip on his shoulder. They think my father is a gangster, Greg said, but they don't really mind. Most rich people have a gangster somewhere in their ancestry. You sound as if you hate Washington. On the contrary, I wouldn't be anywhere else. The power is here. Woody felt he was more high-minded. I'm here because there are things I want to do, changes I want to make. Greg grinned. Same thing, I guess. Power. Woody had not thought of it that way. Greg said, do you think there will be war in Europe? You should know. You're in the State Department. Yeah, but I'm in the press office. All I know is the fairy tales we tell reporters. I have no idea what the truth is. Heck, I don't know either. I've just been with the president, and I don't think even he knows. My sister Daisy is over there. Greg's tone had changed. His worry was evidently genuine, and Woody warmed to him. I know. If there's bombing, even women and children won't be safe.
Do you think the Germans will bomb London? There was only one honest answer. I guess they will. I wish she'd come home. Maybe there won't be a war. Chamberlain, the British premier, made a last-minute deal with Hitler over Czechoslovakia last year. A last-minute sellout. Right. So perhaps he'll do the same over Poland, although time is running out. Greg nodded glumly and changed the subject. Where are you headed? To Joanne Ruzrock's apartment. She's giving a party. I heard about it. I know one of her roommates, but I'm not invited, as you could probably guess. Her building is...
Good God!
Greg stopped in mid-sentence. Woody stopped too. Greg was staring ahead. Following his gaze, Woody saw that he was looking at an attractive black woman walking toward them on E Street. She was about their age, and pretty, with wide, pinky-brown lips that made Woody think about kissing. She had on a plain black dress that might have been part of a waitress uniform, but she wore it with a cute hat and fashionable shoes that gave her a stylish look. She saw the two of them, caught Greg's eye, and looked away. Greg said,
"Jackie? Jackie Jakes?"
The girl ignored him and kept walking, but Woody thought she looked troubled. Greg said,
"Jackie, it's me, Greg Peshkov."
Jackie, if it was she, did not respond, but she looked as if she might be about to burst into tears.
"Jackie, real name Mabel, you know me."
Greg stood in the middle of the sidewalk with his arms spread in a gesture of appeal. She deliberately went around him, not speaking or meeting his eye, and walked on. Greg turned.
"Wait a minute," he called after her. "You ran out on me 4 years ago. You owe me an explanation."
This was uncharacteristic of Greg, Woody thought. He had always been such a smooth operator with girls, at school and at Harvard. Now he seemed genuinely upset, bewildered, hurt, almost desperate. 4 years ago, Woody reflected, could this be the girl in the scandal? It had taken place here in Washington. No doubt she lived here. Greg ran after her. A cab had stopped at the corner and the passenger, a man in a tuxedo, was standing at the curb paying the driver. Jackie jumped in, slamming the door. Greg went to the window and shouted through it,
"Talk to me, please!"
The man in the tuxedo said, "Keep the change," and walked away. The cab moved off, leaving Greg staring after it. He slowly returned to where Woody stood waiting, intrigued.
"I don't understand it," Greg said.
Woody said, "She looked frightened."
"What of? I never did her any harm. I was crazy about her."
"Well, she was scared of something." Greg seemed to shake himself.
"Sorry," he said, "not your problem anyway. My apologies."
"Not at all." Greg pointed to an apartment block a few steps away.
"That's Joanne's building," he said. "Have a good time."
Then he walked away. Somewhat bemused, Woody went to the entrance, but he soon forgot about Greg's romantic life and started to think about his own. Did Joanne really like him? She might not kiss him this evening, but maybe he could ask her for a date. This was a modest apartment house, with no doorman or hall porter. A list in the lobby revealed that Ruzrock shared her place with Stewart and Fisher, presumably two other girls. Woody went up in the elevator. He realized he was empty-handed. He should have brought candy or flowers. He thought about going back to buy something, then decided that would be taking good manners too far. He rang the bell. A girl in her early 20s opened the door. Woody said, "Hello, I'm..."
"Come on in,"
she said, not waiting to hear his name. "The drinks are in the kitchen, and there's food on the table in the living room, if there's any left." She turned away, clearly thinking she had given him sufficient welcome. The small apartment was packed with people drinking, smoking, and shouting at one another over the noise of the phonograph. Joanne had said a few friends, and Woody had imagined 8 or 10 young people sitting around a coffee table discussing the crisis in Europe. He was disappointed. This overcrowded bash would give him little opportunity to demonstrate to Joanne how much he had grown up. He looked around for her. He was taller than most people and could see over the heads. She was not in sight. He pushed through the crowd, searching for her. A girl with plump breasts and nice brown eyes looked up at him as he squeezed past and said, "Hello, big guy. I'm Diana Taverner. What's your name?" "I'm looking for Joanne," he said. She shrugged.
Good luck with that. She turned away. He made his way into the kitchen. The noise level dropped a fraction. Joanne was nowhere to be seen, but he decided to get a drink while he was there. A broad-shouldered man of about 30 was rattling a cocktail shaker. Well-dressed in a tan suit, pale blue shirt, and dark blue tie, he clearly was not a barman, but was acting like a host.
"Scotch is over there," he said to another guest. "Help yourself. I'm making martinis for anyone who's interested."
Woody said, "Got any bourbon?"
"Right here."
The man passed him a bottle.
"I'm Bexforth Ross."
"Woody Doer." Woody found a glass and poured bourbon.
"Ice in that bucket," said Bexforth.
"Where are you from, Woody?"
"I'm an intern in the Senate."
"You?"
"I work in the State Department. I'm in charge of the Italy desk."
He started passing martinis around. Clearly a rising star, Woody thought. The man had so much self-confidence it was irritating.
"I was looking for Joanne." "She's somewhere around. How do you know her?"
Here Woody felt he could show clear superiority.
"Oh, we're old friends,"
he said airily. "In fact, I've known her all my life. We were kids together in Buffalo. How about you?" Bexforth took a long sip of martini and gave a satisfied sigh. Then he looked speculatively at Woody.
"I haven't known Joanne as long as you have," he said, "but I guess I know her better."
"How so?"
"I'm planning to marry her."
Woody felt as if he had been slapped.
"Marry her?" "Yes. Isn't that great?"
Woody could not hide his dismay.
"Does she know about this?"
Bexforth laughed and patted Woody's shoulder condescendingly.
"She sure does, and she's all for it. I'm the luckiest guy in the world."
Clearly Bexforth had divined that Woody was attracted to Joanne. Woody felt a fool.
"Congratulations," he said dispiritedly.
"Thank you. And now I must circulate. Good talking to you, Woody."
"My pleasure." Bexforth moved away. Woody put his drink down untasted.
"Fuck it," he said quietly. Then he left.
4. The first day of September was sultry in Berlin. Carla von Ulrich woke up sweaty and uncomfortable, her bedsheets thrown off during the warm night. She looked out of her bedroom window to see low gray clouds hanging over the city, keeping heat in like a saucepan lid. Today was a big day for her. In fact, it would determine the course of her life. She stood in front of the mirror. She had her mother's coloring, the dark hair and green eyes of the Fitzherberts. She was prettier than Maud, who had an angular face, striking rather than beautiful. Yet there was a bigger difference. Her mother attracted just about every man she met. Carla, by contrast, could not flirt. She watched other 18-year-old girls doing it, simpering, pulling their sweaters tight over their breasts, tossing their hair and batting their eyelashes, and she just felt embarrassed. Her mother was more subtle, of course, so that men hardly knew they were being enchanted, but it was essentially the same game. Today, however, Carla did not want to appear sexy. On the contrary, she needed to look practical, sensible, and capable. She put on a plain stone-colored cotton dress that came to mid-calf, stepped into her flat, unglamorous school sandals, and wove her hair into two plaits in the approved German maiden fashion. The mirror showed her an ideal girl student, conservative, dull, sexless. She was up and dressed before the rest of the family. The maid, Ada, was in the kitchen, and Carla helped her set out the breakfast things. Her brother appeared next. Eric, 19 and sporting a clipped black mustache, supported the Nazis, infuriating the rest of his family. He was a student at the Charité, the medical school of the University of Berlin, as was his best friend and fellow Nazi, Hermann Braun. The von Ulrichs could not afford tuition fees, of course, but Eric had won a scholarship. Carla had applied for the same scholarship to study at the same institution. Her interview was today. If she was successful, she would study and become a doctor. If not, she had no idea what else she would do. The coming to power of the Nazis had ruined her parents' lives. Her father was no longer a deputy in the Reichstag, having lost his job when the Social Democratic Party became illegal,
along with all other parties except for the Nazis. There was no work her father could do that would use his expertise as a politician and a diplomat. He scraped a living translating German newspaper articles for the British Embassy, where he still had a few friends. Mother had once been a famous left-wing journalist, but newspapers were no longer allowed to publish her articles. Carla found it heartbreaking. She was deeply devoted to her family, which included Ada. She was saddened by the decline in her father, who in her childhood had been a hard-working and politically powerful man, and was now simply defeated. Even worse was the brave face put on by her mother, a famous suffragette leader in England before the war, now scraping a few marks by giving piano lessons. But they said they could bear anything as long as their children grew up to lead happy and fulfilled lives. Carla had always taken it for granted that she would spend her life making the world a better place, as her parents had. She did not know whether she would have followed her father into politics or her mother into journalism, but both were out of the question now. What else was she to do, under a government that prized ruthlessness and brutality above all else? Her brother had given her the clue. Doctors made the world a better place regardless of the government. So she had made it her ambition to go to medical school. She had studied harder than any other girl in her class, and she had passed every exam with top marks, especially the sciences. She was better qualified than her brother to win a scholarship. "There are no girls at all in my year," Eric said. He sounded grumpy. Carla thought he disliked the idea of her following in his footsteps. Their parents were proud of his achievements, despite his repellent politics. Perhaps he was afraid of being outshone. Carla said, "All my grades are better than yours. Biology, chemistry, math." "All right, all right. And the scholarship is available to female students in principle. I checked." Their mother came in at the end of this exchange, dressed in a gray, watered silk bathrobe with the cord doubled around her narrow waist. "They should follow their own rules," she said. "This is Germany, after all." Mother said she loved her adopted country, and perhaps she did. But since the coming of the Nazis, she had taken to making wearily ironic remarks. Carla dipped bread into milky coffee. "How will you feel, Mother, if England attacks Germany?" "Miserably unhappy, as I felt last time," she replied. "I was married to your father throughout the Great War, and every day for more than 4 years I was terrified that he would be killed." Eric said in a challenging tone, "But whose side will you take?" "I'm German," she said. "I married, for better or worse. Of course, we never foresaw anything as wicked and oppressive as this Nazi regime. No one did." Eric grunted in protest, and she ignored him. "But a vow is a vow. And anyway, I love your father." Carla said, "We're not at war yet." "Not quite," said Mother. "If the Poles have any sense, they will back down and give Hitler what he asks for." "They should," said Eric. "Germany is strong now. We can take what we want, whether they like it or not." Mother rolled her eyes up. "God spare us." A car horn sounded outside. Carla smiled. A minute later, her friend, Frieda Frank, entered the kitchen. She was going to accompany Carla to the interview, just to give moral support. She too was dressed in sober schoolgirl fashion, though she, unlike Carla, had a wardrobe full of stylish clothes. She was followed in by her older brother. Carla thought Werner Frank was wonderful. Unlike so many handsome boys, he was kind and thoughtful and funny. He had once been very left-wing, but all that seemed to have faded away, and he was non-political now. He had had a string of beautiful and stylish girlfriends. If Carla had known how to flirt, she would have started with him. Mother said, "I'd offer you coffee, Werner, but ours is ersatz, and I know you have the real thing at home." "Shall I steal some from our kitchen for you, Frau von Ulrich?" he said. "I think you deserve it." Mother blushed slightly, and Carla realized, with a twinge of disapproval, that even at 48 Mother was susceptible to Werner's charm. Werner glanced at a gold wristwatch. "I have to go," he said. "Life is completely frantic at the Air Ministry these days." Frieda said, "Thank you for the lift." Carla said to Frieda, "Wait a minute. If you came in Werner's car, where's your bike?" "Outside. We strapped it to the back of the car." The two girls belonged to the Mercury Cycling Club and went everywhere by bike. Werner said, "Best wishes for the interview, Carla. Bye, everyone." Carla swallowed the last of her bread. As she was about to leave, her father came down. He had not shaved or put on a tie. He had been quite plump when Carla was a girl, but now he was thin. He kissed Carla affectionately. Mother said, "We haven't listened to the news." She turned on the radio that stood on the shelf. While the set was warming up, Carla and Frida left the house, so they did not hear the news. The university hospital was in Mitte, the central area of Berlin where the von Ulrichs lived, so Carla and Frida had a short bicycle ride. Carla began to feel nervous. The fumes from car exhausts nauseated her, and she wished she had not eaten breakfast. They reached the hospital, a new building put up in the 20s, and found their way to the room of Professor Bayer, who had the job of recommending a student for the scholarship. A haughty secretary said they were early and told them to wait. Carla wished she had worn a hat and gloves. That would have made her look older and more authoritative, like someone sick people would trust. The secretary might have been polite to a girl in a hat. The wait was long, but Carla was sorry when it came to an end, and the secretary said the professor was ready to see her. Frida whispered, "Good luck." Carla went in. Bayer was a thin man in his 40s with a small gray mustache. He sat behind a desk, wearing a tan linen jacket over the waistcoat of a gray business suit. On the wall was a photograph of him shaking hands with Hitler. He did not greet Carla, but barked, "What is an imaginary number?" She was taken aback by his abruptness, but at least it was an easy question. "The square root of a negative real number, for example, the square root of -1, she said in a shaky voice. "It cannot be assigned a real numerical value, but can nevertheless be used in calculations." He seemed a bit surprised. Perhaps he had expected to floor her completely. "Correct," he said after a momentary hesitation. She looked around. There was no chair for her. Was she to be interviewed standing up? He asked her some questions in chemistry and biology, all of which she answered easily. She began to feel a bit less nervous. Then he suddenly said, "Do you faint at the sight of blood?"
"No, sir."
"Aha!" he said triumphantly. "How do you know?"
"I delivered a baby when I was 11 years old, she said. "That was quite bloody."
"You should have sent for a doctor."
"I did," she said indignantly. "But babies don't wait for doctors."
"Hmm." Bayer stood up. "Wait there." He left the room. Carla stayed where she was. She was being subjected to a harsh test, but so far she thought she was doing all right. Fortunately, she was used to give-and-take arguments with men and women of all ages. Combative discussions were commonplace in the von Ulrich house, and she had been holding her own with her parents and brother for as long as she could remember. Bayer was gone for several minutes. What was he doing? Had he gone to fetch a colleague to meet this unprecedentedly brilliant girl applicant? That seemed too much to hope for. She was tempted to pick up one of the books on his shelf and read, but she was scared of offending him, so she stood still and did nothing. He came back after 10 minutes with a pack of cigarettes. Surely he had not kept her standing in the middle of the room all this time while he went to the tobacconist's shop? Or was that another test? She began to feel angry. He took his time lighting up, as if he needed to collect his thoughts. He blew out smoke and said, "How would you, as a woman, deal with a man who had an infection of the penis?" She was embarrassed and felt herself blush. She had never discussed the penis with a man. But she knew she had to be robust about such things if she wanted to be a doctor. "In the same way that you, as a man, would deal with a vaginal infection," she said. He looked horrified, and she feared she had been insolent. Hastily, she went on, "I would examine the infected area carefully, try to establish the nature of the infection, and probably treat it with sulfonamide, although I have to admit we did not cover this in my school biology course." He said skeptically, "Have you ever seen a naked man?"
"Yes."
He affected to be outraged.
"But you are a single girl."
"When my grandfather was dying, he was bedridden and incontinent. I helped my mother keep him clean. She could not manage on her own. He was too heavy."
She tried a smile. "Women do these things all the time, Professor, for the very young and the very old.
the sick and the helpless. We're used to it. It's only men who find such tasks embarrassing.
He was looking more and more cross, even though she was answering well. What was going wrong? It was almost as if he would have been happier for her to be intimidated by his manner and to give stupid replies. He put out his cigarette thoughtfully in the ashtray on his desk.
I'm afraid you are not suitable as a candidate for this scholarship, he said.
She was astonished. How had she failed? She had answered every question. Why not? She said.
My qualifications are irreproachable.
You are unwomanly. You talk freely of the vagina and the penis.
It was you who started that. I merely answered your question.
You have clearly been brought up in a coarse environment where you saw the nakedness of your male relatives.
Do you think old people's diapers should be changed by men? I'd like to see you do it.
First of all, you are disrespectful and insolent. You asked me challenging questions. If I had given you timid replies, you would have said I wasn't tough enough to be a doctor, wouldn't you? He was momentarily speechless, and she realized that was exactly what he would have done.
You've wasted my time, she said, and she went to the door.
Get married, he said. Produce children for the Führer. That's your role in life. Do your duty. She went out and slammed the door. Frieda looked up in alarm.
What happened?
Carla headed for the exit without replying. She caught the eye of the secretary, who looked pleased, clearly knowing what had happened. Carla said to her, You can wipe that smirk off your face, you dried-up old bitch. She had the satisfaction of seeing the woman's shock and horror. Outside the building, she said to Frieda, He had no intention of recommending me for the scholarship, because I'm a woman. My qualifications were irrelevant. I did all that work for nothing. Then she burst into tears. Frieda put her arms around her. After a minute, she felt better. I'm not going to raise children for the damned Führer, she muttered.
What?
Let's go home. I'll tell you when we get there. They climbed onto their bikes. There was a strange air in the streets, but Carla was too full of her own woes to wonder what was going on. People were gathering around the loudspeakers that sometimes broadcast Hitler's speeches from the Kroll Opera, the building that was being used instead of the burnt-out Reichstag. Presumably he was about to speak. When they got back to the von Ulrich townhouse, mother and father were still in the kitchen, father sitting next to the radio with a frown of concentration.
They turned me down,
Carla said. Regardless of what their rules say, they don't want to give a scholarship to a girl.
Oh, Carla, I'm so sorry,
said mother.
What's on the radio?
Haven't you heard? Said mother. We invaded Poland this morning. We're at war. 5. The London season was over, but most people were still in town because of the crisis. Parliament, normally in recess at this time of year, had been specially recalled. But there were no parties, no royal receptions, no balls. It was like being at a seaside resort in February, Daisy thought. Today was Saturday, and she was getting ready to go to dinner at the home of her father-in-law, Earl Fitzherbert. What could be more dull? She sat at her dressing table wearing an evening gown in eau de Nil silk, with a V-neck and a pleated skirt. She had silk flowers in her hair and a fortune in diamonds around her neck. Her husband, Boy, was getting ready in his dressing room. She was pleased he was here. He spent many nights elsewhere. Although they lived in the same Mayfair house, sometimes several days would go by without their meeting, but he was at home tonight. She held in her hand a letter from her mother in Buffalo. Olga had divined that Daisy was discontented in her marriage. There must have been hints in Daisy's letters home. Mother had good intuition. I only want you to be happy, she wrote, so listen when I tell you not to give up too soon. You're going to be Countess Fitzherbert one day. And your son, if you have one, will be the Earl. You might regret throwing all that away just because your husband didn't pay you enough attention. She might be right. People had been addressing Daisy as my lady for almost 3 years, yet it still gave her a little jolt of pleasure every time, like a puff on a cigarette. But Boy seemed to think that marriage need make no great difference to his life. He spent evenings with his men friends, traveled all over the country to go horse racing, and rarely told his wife what his plans were.
Daisy found it embarrassing to go to a party and be surprised to meet her husband there. But if she wanted to know where he was going, she had to ask his valet, and that was too demeaning. Would he gradually grow up and start to behave as a husband should, or would he always be like this? He put his head around her door.
Come on, Daisy, we're late.
She put Mother's letter in a drawer, locked it, and went out. Boy was waiting in the hall, wearing a tuxedo. Fitz had at last succumbed to fashion and permitted informal short dinner jackets for family dinners at home. They could have walked to Fitz's house, but it was raining, so Boy had had the car brought around. It was a Bentley Airline Saloon, cream-colored with white wall tires. Boy shared his father's love of beautiful cars. Boy drove. Daisy hoped he would let her drive back. She enjoyed it, and anyway, he was not safe after dinner, especially on wet roads. London was preparing for war. Barrage balloons floated over the city at a height of 2,000 feet to impede bombers. In case that failed, sandbags were stacked outside important buildings. Alternate curbstones had been painted white for the benefit of drivers in the blackout, which had begun yesterday. There were white stripes on large trees, street statues, and other obstacles that might cause accidents. Princess Bea welcomed Boy and Daisy. In her 50s, she was quite fat, but she still dressed like a girl. Tonight she wore a pink gown embroidered with beads and sequins. She never spoke about the story Daisy's father had told at the wedding, but she had stopped hinting that Daisy was socially inferior, and now always spoke to Daisy with courtesy, if not warmth. Daisy was cautiously friendly, and treated Bea like a slightly dotty aunt. Boy's younger brother Andy was there. He and May had two children, and May looked, to Daisy's interested eye, as if she might be expecting a third. Boy wanted a son, of course, to be heir to the Fitzherbert title and fortune, but so far Daisy had failed to get pregnant. It was a sore point, and the evident fecundity of Andy and May made it worse. Daisy would have had a better chance if Boy spent more nights at home. She was delighted to see her friend Ava Murray there, but without her husband. Jimmy Murray, now a captain, was with his unit and had not been able to get away, for most troops were in barracks, and their officers were with them. Ava was family now because Jimmy was May's brother, and therefore an in-law. So Boy had been forced to overcome his prejudice against Jews and be polite to Ava. Ava adored Jimmy as much now as she had 3 years ago when she married him. They too had produced two children in 3 years. But Ava looked worried tonight, and Daisy could guess why.
How are your parents? She said.
They can't get out of Germany, Ava said miserably. The government won't give them exit visas.
Can't Fitz help? He's tried.
What have they done to deserve this?
It's not them particularly. There are thousands of German Jews in the same position. Only a few get visas. I'm so sorry.
Daisy was more than sorry. She squirmed with embarrassment when she recalled how she and Boy had supported the fascists in the early days. Her doubts had grown rapidly as the brutality of fascism at home and abroad had become more and more obvious, and in the end, she had been relieved when Fitz had complained.